For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Well, the group Oklahoma Taxpayers Unite, which is backed by former U.S. Senator Tom Coburn, begins gathering signatures to veto the revenue package, which is funding pay raises for teachers, support staff, and state workers. Organizers have until July 18th to gather 41,000 signatures to get it on the November ballot. But Neva, if they just get the signatures, will the raises get put on hold?
I think that's a question. Obviously, everything gets put on hold until we get through this process. Can they get the signatures? Can the signatures be sufficient to move it on toward a possible time on the ballot? When will that be? I mean, it would appear that all efforts on their part are to get it on the November ballot, but that may or may not happen. So I think right now it's the wait and see of can this group really pull out all the stops, get the signatures on time, and then see where the process moves from there.
Ryan.
Yeah, you know, Dr. Coburn's taking time at yelling at kids to get off his lawn to, you know, pass this signature petition around. I don't know that they get the signatures. I think that, you know, what we saw was an overwhelming support, tens of thousands of teachers and an historic march at the state capitol. They all have friends. They all have family members. You can bet between now and that signature deadline, they're going to be encouraging everyone they can. Do not sign the signature. Do not undo this. Do not put us into fiscal turmoil, which is exactly what this would do. There are so many uncertainties as to what happens. You know, Neva mentioned, does it go on hold if they get the signatures? You know, these are a lot of interesting and troubling legal questions that the state, frankly, shouldn't be facing right now. I mean, we're at a point where it seems we can maybe begin to say that we're turning a corner. I don't want to say that we've turned a corner, but we can maybe see that we're beginning to turn a corner. This would be a tremendous step back for Oklahoma.
In 1990, they had a similar bill that was passed, and it actually did make it all the way to the ballot to try and veto. It didn't pass ultimately.
And I see this somewhat like what we saw in the last 1 cent sales tax. You have a process, you get it on the ballot, and then you have the hard fought back and forth trying to make your case or trying to undo that case. And in this instance, I think the threshold is can they get the signatures? Yes, I think if they make a concerted effort, yes, they get the signatures. Now, beyond that, what happens in a campaign when you raise all of the questions on both sides? I mean, if the proponents say, look, we're for teacher raise, but we think that they should have audited the agencies, they should have found reforms, they should have found different ways to come up with the money, ultimately the voters are going to get to probably to decide that at some point. But in the meantime, there is a lot of uncertainty that does lead to more questions than answers at this point.
And Michael, you mentioned back to 1990, 91, 92, the passage of State Question 640.
Right.
There was State Question 639. Former Speaker Steve Lewis has a great post that was featured on the Oklahoma Policy Institute blog about a week ago about the history of that. There was State Question 639, which Neva mentioned did not pass, but the proponents or the opponents of 639 spent so much time trying to defeat that they, you know, in Speaker Lewis's estimation, they were just beleaguered, they were tired, and then when they walked into the subsequent vote on State Question 640, they didn't have the resources to defeat it. So, you know, this could be, even if this fails, even if they fail to get the signatures, even if it fails at the ballot box, assuming they get the signatures, you know, there is, you know, a larger stretch here of time that we have to be concerned about for further efforts to whittle away at what the legislature just did.
Could they actually make 640 worse, where they basically just say that no lawmaker can ever raise taxes? I mean, that's...
Instead
of the 75% threshold, they just say a 100% threshold.
Given the climate we're in right now, I think it would be wise to say that you never say never, because it's a very slippery slope that we see with these state questions. And who knows in the future what other state questions will come in the aftermath of this. I think this really opens the door to a lot of other issues that really kind of snowball off of this particular set of circumstances.
And it may tee up state questions in the future to relax the requirements of State Question 640. I'm kind of surprised that we don't see that right now, But, you know, what we got to, this budget agreement that we got to, the teacher funding agreement that we got to, whether you think it was sufficient or not, it was historic. It overcame 640 for the first time in two decades. And, you know, here we are looking at something that would roll that back. I frankly think that the bipartisan effort, the Republicans and the Democrats that came together in the year-plus effort to get this here, I think that if you ask them, do we need to make 640 tougher, they would say no. Mm-hmm.
Lawmakers are pushing through last-minute bills in the hopes of ending the 2018 legislative session 3 weeks early. Already controversial bills to allow anyone over 21 to carry guns without a license and lets judges rather than juries sentence juveniles to life without parole are going to Governor Fallon. Ryan, are you surprised to see this move by the legislature?
Well, I'm not surprised to see the move. I'm surprised to see how some of these moves are happening in the last few days. It's almost like the legislature is, you know, saying, well, we raised taxes. We need to do our best in these last weeks or so to remind people that we don't like gay people, that we really like guns, and, you know, we're going to be tough on crime. Because we've seen permitless carry, which is just really a very, you know, dangerous idea, you know, especially in the climate that we're in right now, where we're beginning to recognize that more guns equals more gun violence. Putting more people on the streets with guns without any sort of regulations or restrictions is just, you know, an insane idea. We have a bill that would allow faith-based organizations to deny adoptions to LGBTQ parents based upon the religious liberty beliefs of the organization. Now, the interesting thing about this at the last minute was it was probably going to fail in the committee, the conference committee that it was assigned in. The speaker creates an ad hoc committee at the last minute, stacks it with members that will support the bill so that it can get out to the House floor. Now, we're taping this Thursday morning. Who knows whether or not this ultimately passes in the Senate or the House? But the extraordinary effort to discriminate against gay and lesbian parents in the state of Oklahoma, or would-be parents, is just, you know, despicable. And then, you know, finally, a couple of things that haven't happened: regulations on modernization of alcohol and liquor that is going to go into effect later this year. Regulations for medical cannabis, which could pass in June, that's probably still not there. Those two things in and of themselves could trigger a special session later this summer.
Neva.
Well, and there has been that talk about special session. Now, will it be later this summer? I don't know
if they can really
come through that. But you're right. I mean, the last minute scramble, which always is in May, now we've compounded it with trying to push the calendar up and get out early, which typically they talk about but never get done. It would appear that whether it is at the weekend today on Friday that they're out, or whether they wind up having to come back in early next week and still continue to kind of fizzle, you know, kind of push through this stuff. The interesting issue is, you're right, Ryan. I mean, you have this last minute flurry of really jockeying. It's internal fights. It's bickering. It's leadership. It's kind of leadership skirmishes to some degree. And what it does, though, is it puts all of these lawmakers going back home, many of whom have a looming June 26 primary facing them to have to reconcile all of this. So I think it doesn't bode well for unity in the ranks on either side when you have this last minute give and take, and then you have just the housekeeping things. I mean, on the Senate side, they had a stack of 100 plus Senate nominations that were waiting to be confirmed, and the pressure of trying to get that through the process, which many folks obviously have a high degree of interest in. So, I don't know that it's anything new, but when you're looking at it closely, I mean, it does seem to be more chaos than control or some sort of orderly resolution of these issues. When the dust settles, I think it would be fascinating to talk about what did and didn't happen on some of these big bills.
And meanwhile, Democrats say there's even more that could be done with revenue. There was the tax credits. There's so many things that Democrats say, well, we're leaving.
And wind and some of these things kept coming back up. I mean, for that very reason. I mean, there were these last ditch efforts to kind of resurrect some of this conversation in some of these areas. But the bottom line is, I don't think there's been a big appetite to want to go ahead and go down that road some resolution.
And especially when you're trying to do it in a week period.
Right.
I mean, most of these revenue, wind and everything came up, middle end of last week. I mean, it'd been on the table, but there were some real concrete proposals last week to try to rush all that through. Seemed really difficult, especially given the roadblocks that you'd seen to it earlier this session and then the special session before that. The new revenue stuff never really seemed like it was going to happen. I think that any sort of revenue package, if it didn't happen in the context of the teacher strike, it wasn't going to happen at all this
year. But doesn't all this blame land at the feet of your leadership in the House and Senate? Because you don't need to leave now. It's not sine die. You have 3 weeks if you choose to stay. It just seems like
that's absolutely correct. Yeah. I mean, they're in control of their destiny in terms of waiting, kind of putting themselves in a place where they can go till the end of May if they choose to. And who knows? I mean, we may be speaking prematurely. The wheels may come off and they may in fact be in another full week or longer. So, all of the good intentions sometimes, go by the board when they start to get in these critical fights on some of these bills.
Yeah. Medical cannabis and alcohol modernization regulations. Those two things just need to happen. I mean, I think polls show that State Question 788 is likely to pass in June. And if it passes without some sort of regulatory scheme in effect, they're probably going to have to come back. Otherwise, you're going to have chaos in the regulatory system. Same with the alcohol modernization that passed at the ballot box. It changes October 1st. That's before they come back next February. Yeah. We've got 3 weeks that if all they did were those two things, they could get them done and probably avoid a special session.
But they wouldn't limit it to those two things.
There's no way.
Therein is the problem.
that's true. Governor Fallon wastes no time in signing the $7.6 billion budget, which hit her desk last week. Neva, do you think Fallon, like many lawmakers, is just ready to end this budget issue, which have lasted more than a year?
I think what has been lost in signing that bill was really what the bill said. I mean, we've lost a lot of in terms of just the backdrop of the teacher walkout and all that ensued as it went beyond the first week. I mean, the bottom line is that K-12 schools got almost $3 billion more in money, which was a 20% increase. And when you look at the bottom line, the teachers also had the largest pay raise in state history. Now, whether or not that average $6,100 stays, I mean, with what we talked about with the possibility of the state question, but when you look at what was done in that budget, when you saw the increases, I mean, really what Oklahoma teachers, I think, have not really heard in the midst of all of the clamor back and forth and all of the contentiousness that ensued is the fact that they now would rank as the second highest salaries in our region. And if you take into account the cost of living, they would be the 12th highest in the country. So, I mean, there are some good takeaways. I mean, whether they want to continue to, to fight on the margins on some of this stuff or whether they have to go back to a full fight if the state question were to prevail and the legislature has to, deal with the aftermath of that. The bottom line is, Ryan is right. There was a bipartisan, very tough fought, very difficult vote that ultimately got a budget that says those things that I just mentioned. And I think those have been lost among the public in terms of what's really happened. And if when the dust settles, the folks back home can begin to see what really did happen and what the takeaway really is, I think we'd have a whole different picture out there. And it's regrettable that the OEA and some of the national union movement has continued to try to infuse this hysteria and this kind of almost a militant attitude among some of the folks that somehow they have gotten a raw deal. Actually, they got a great deal. It's the question is, will they be able to keep it?
But again, like we talked about last week, the reason why maybe no one's really talking about this is because I don't think anyone wants to admit the reason why there's so much extra money for education, for higher education, for roads, for bridges, for all that kind of stuff, is because they had to raise taxes.
Well, and even with the raised taxes, though, I mean, we still don't get ourselves back to normal. I mean, we haven't righted the ship with the public employee pay raises, with the teacher pay raises. The $50 million increase, even with that $50 million increase into common ed over and above teacher salaries, that's $145 million less than it was in fiscal year 2009. And that's as K-12 enrollment has grown by 50,000 in the state of Oklahoma. So when we begin to adjust these budget numbers for inflation from a decade ago from where this fiscal year is, we're still well below where we were then. And, we could say, well, we're making do. We're just simply not. And I think that if we look at everything from adult protective services to the Department of Corrections to Common Ed, we're still well behind. Now, I will say that there was never any likelihood that the legislature was going to do what they should have done this session. I don't think they're ever actually going to do what they should have done, and that was to put all the revenue options on the table and really come up with a budget that begins to put us back to our 2009 levels of funding. But what they did was historic. And you know, I do think that we have begun to see this idea that just simply cutting and cutting and cutting doesn't get the state where it needs to be, and it leaves us with huge holes in state services. So, you know, as upset as I am that the legislature didn't go as far as they needed to go, man, I am incredibly grateful that we're walking out of this legislative session where it seems to, that we have begun to turn this corner and recognize that we have to have some responsibility in the way we finance our government.
And the bottom line is, we were never going to write everything in one session. I mean, the fact that we did make a real shift, the fact that we did have a budget that allowed for really increases in all of the core services. I mean, percentage-wise, budget increases. Is it where everyone needed to be? Corrections, did they get what they needed and what we know they probably truly do need in terms of additional appropriations? No. But the fact that we're not going backwards, I think, is not only a relief, but it's a positive sign. And I think until we start talking about it as being forward progress, I mean, we're going to really set the stage for these new lawmakers, all of these new faces coming in next year, to not really approach it in the proper way. I mean, we have a good launch point here, and we should move forward. And the idea that we're just going to, you know, raise taxes unlimited and solve all the problems at once, as long as there's a Republican-dominated legislature, that's not going to happen. So what we need to have is realistic approaches to these issues that do get bipartisan support, which is necessary and should happen. And as a result of that, then I think we will continue to dig our way out of what was a very deep hole for a long time.
And fewer one-time funds, which were actually handicapping.
Yeah, this is the most responsible budget in a long time.
Right.
This is the most responsible budget under Republican leadership that I can imagine. I can imagine a more responsible budget, but that I can remember. Yeah. I think that Neva's right. I mean, this is something that, you know, folks, you know, should be. We should be grateful that we got what we got.
And we shouldn't demagogue it. We should make sure the clear facts get out about this instead of trying to raise this level of, frankly, a very disingenuous dialogue about the education situation in Oklahoma. And hopefully the teachers will begin to see what these lawmakers did and not just, you know, believe that they need to continue to come up there and, you know, and feel like nothing has been done.
But
because
so much-
I think they've lost sight of what really did happen and what that budget that the governor signed really does show.
But only if it holds true, if Senator Tom Coburn comes
through. If it holds
true,
and it may hold true, yeah. And the public may be more, the public was very willing to go along with the idea that there was a problem, teachers needed a raise. They even were willing to see the teachers go to the Capitol in a very calm, dignified manner and, you know, talk to their lawmakers and watch the process as it unfolded. I think when it became more of a strike and more of a mindset that we're just going to kind of go on the attack, I think the sentiment changed not only at the Capitol, but I think even in the public eye, it was a very different view. So if we can get that back and kind of stopgap that and start from where we really are with this budget and see if it will hold, I think that lends for very bright prospects for the future.
But this budget is a start. I mean, I think that, you know, that's the thing, is that I think that lawmakers need to realize that it's a start, and I think their constituents need to continue to put that pressure on them. And that means, you know, showing back up at the Capitol. The reason that we got the budget that we got this year was because the lawmakers did it with the pressure of their constituencies in their hallways. And, you know, that was an important lesson for teachers. I think it's an important lesson for everybody that cares about state funding.
I think it is true, but I think the other side of that is in week two and three, when teachers were still going to the Capitol, still being released to do that, there were substitutes that the district were having to put in those classrooms to keep education going on in those districts. So there is a way to do that, but you have to think about the consequences and have to think about what the fallout potentially of that is with the with the parents and the folks back home when they really see what's really happening on the local front.
Meanwhile, we do have an election to deal with.
Really? Yeah. When is that, by the way?
I know. So, much, much sooner than we think. Let's see. Candidates for governor report fundraising for the first quarter. Tulsa businessman Kevin Stitt raised the most during the past 3 months at more than $800,000, but he also gave himself $400,000. $1,000 of that, while former Oklahoma City Mayor Mick Cornett actually leads in fundraising from donors other than himself at just under $440,000. Meanwhile, Lieutenant Governor Todd Lamb leads in overall funding with a war chest of nearly $3.5 million. Even the fundraising seems to match pretty closely to polling in the upcoming primary.
And I think that is usually the bottom line, whether anyone likes it or not. It takes money to raise your name ID. It takes money to run a statewide campaign in 77 counties. And it takes that, and that money becomes the breakout. The fourth candidate is the candidate that is self-funded. I mean, Gary Richardson's put $1 million of his own money in, raised about $100,000 above that. So I think that's where it separates the pack, and I think that's what we will continue to see as we move forward toward the end of the primary. The question is now, with those resources, how do they message to those likely primary voters, and how will that turn out with a field as crowded as it is? I mean, it not only is it's a two-pronged proposition for these folks. They've got to make the runoff, and in the runoff, where can they garner the support from some of those folks that didn't make the runoff, and where will that support go? So it's a real chess game when you get into this kind of a scenario on the Republican side, much different from the Democrat mm-hmm. side, where you have less competition and frankly at the moment less focus.
Right, and that's Democratic candidate Drew Edmondson actually came in fourth overall, not including just other Republicans, with more than $305,000 and overall a war chest of more than $1 million. Ryan, do you think fundraising will pick up for Edmondson after the primary?
We'll pick up. I mean, I think he's doing incredibly well. $1.3 million raised. I mean, he's neck and neck with a lot of these Republican folks, with the exception of Lamb, who's been raising money since 1983 for the gubernatorial race. So I think that he's doing incredibly well. Connie Johnson has $60,000 in the bank. I think that if Drew Edmondson almost might wish that Connie Johnson had a little bit more money so that she could run a little bit more competitive campaign against him in this primary, because Neve is right. There is a Republican chess game going on right now, and it seems to be that Lamb, Cornett, and Stitt are all competing for those one and two spots to walk into a runoff. But anybody else, is going to wait there for somebody to trip up and make a mistake. And if you're Lamb, if you're leading in the polls, you got $3 million in the bank, put the guy in the bunker so he doesn't say something stupid between now and the primary, and he's probably going to make the runoff. So it's that number two spot between Stitt and Cornett. And then, if one of them fumbles, somebody else could be there. I don't think it's going to be Richardson, because that guy's in fourth place and he's already started fumbling the ball. But with Edmondson, he's going to have to do something between now and that primary and that runoff to remind folks that he's out there on that campaign trail. He is an incredibly serious candidate. There's been very few people that have been as prepared as he is to be governor of the state of Oklahoma. He knows what it's like to be on a statewide campaign. He's going to be a formidable challenge to any of these Republican nominees in November. And I think if there's ever been a year in recent history where a Democrat could win a statewide election, 2018 is it. I mean, this, we talk about the blue wave around the country. There will be an impact here in Oklahoma as well. It may not be as overwhelming as we're going to see in some other states, but it will happen, whether it's in the 5th District or even statewide for governor. Drew Edmondson's just got to make sure that he can stay on the radar between now and the end of the Republican runoff.
The last Republican midterm was 2006, where the Democrats took over all statewide offices. So for anybody, any Republican out there said, oh, it's no big deal, the Republicans will stay. It's not necessarily a guaranteed win for the Republican Party in November.
There's no guaranteed wins. And I think when you look at the national picture, I mean, it becomes something that does impact the state elections. I mean, as we know, I mean, we've nationalized most of the local elections now for many, many years. And I think we have that developing again. I mean, when you have Nancy Pelosi basically saying, hey, we're going to take back over Congress and I'm going to be the speaker again. I mean, that does that may motivate the Democrat base, but it also juices up the Republicans and gives them a talking point, just like they had for 8 years with Barack Obama. So it's always the give and take of who's in the White House and who the out party is. But the bottom line is, I think it does have some significant wind that blows back into the state in terms of nationalizing the picture. And that has tended to work very well for Republicans for a long, long time.
And also for the Republican Party, you've got these 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 people in the background. Do you think there's going to be a lot of push for them to try and get to that one or two spot in the next month?
They're going to do everything they can to get that to that number two spot in the primary to walk into the runoff. I don't think that I don't think that, you know, a Dan Fisher thinks that he's going to come out number one in the primary, but if he thinks that he can edge his way into a runoff, you know, he's going to try to do that. I would be surprised. I mean, Dan Fisher's not going to be there, but it's interesting now.
Don't they try to then push it?
But it's also like the presidential, you know, multi-way field. Yeah. I mean, it's about what you do if you don't make it. If you've proven that you have a constituency, if you've proven you have a message, whether that's 10%, 8%, whatever that percent is, if you have a block of votes, then you become someone that everyone else is very interested in, and it does allow you to continue to message and bring your issues that you're very passionate about to the forefront, not only in the runoff, but down in the general election. Well, so
especially in the runoff, though. The runoff's a sprint, and you know, if you know, say Dan Fisher doesn't make that runoff, which Dan Fisher's not going to make the runoff, but if he does not, you know, he has a constituency that he could throw to one of those two folks, and that could ingratiate him to, you know, whoever that nominee is ultimately if they end up winning, and they can point
and
to
really,
oh, hey,
in primaries like this,
this,
I think it is the question of not only who your first choice is, but who your second choice is, and that trend, as they begin to poll all of these major contenders, they will begin to look at that very seriously. Not only how am I doing just in general with the primary voters, but what's going to happen and how, where am I as the number two person in that crowded field?
This makes a great case for ranked voting and why we need to have instant primary.
I wasn't trying to make that case.
Instant runoff so that we vote folks for one and two in this primary. Uh-huh. And we don't have to have a runoff.
Right.
Too bad we don't have that.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.